Pivot Show this week. Your questions, hot one.
Pooty said hot one.
Your questions, hot one.
AKA part one.
I'm Christia, with me Simon. If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that a bleeped version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean Combrink for doing that for us. I am away on holiday for 2 weeks. I'm technically already on the second half of my holiday and I haven't left yet, so because we're
this is
travel.
Very awkward time travel.
So we have decided we've been behind on our questions, so we decided to do for the 2 weeks while I'm away, just to answer questions, so no like topic up front. So let's get right into it. So if you sent your questions around the beginning of September, hopefully we'll get to you in this show or the next one.
Yeah, and if the world has ended or something, don't blame us. We're time traveling. We're like this.
We probably caused it with all this time travel.
I mean, we are fully a month before what this date is going out. I mean, this is what? We are the 19th.
19th of September. And yeah, so and this is on the 21st of October. So the win of the week this week is Jonathan, who took on the task of explaining the Signia fees to me. So I don't know if you remember, a while back we spoke about this.
They are complex.
So I've been interested in, because I'm doing my RA differently this year, instead of popping my RA allocation straight into my retirement annuity, I'm putting it in my bond first with the idea of putting it into my RA later, although I might be spending all of it in Cuba as we speak.
No, having spent it all in Cuba, you're
as
no longer
we have
there.
Spoken. Oh, God. Anyway, so I was interested in this RA idea because a lot of you have been writing us, telling us with Signia, you can build your own RA from passive products in the Signia stable, and you can be very aggressive, because normally how it works is the RA providers, when they do an aggressive RA, they still include like 20% cash and bond like product, so you miss out on a little bit of growth, which is insane because your RA is the investment you'll have for the longest period. So Jonathan had the same idea, and I asked him, I was like, cool, if like I'm open to it, but please try and explain the fees on the Signia platform to me, which is what he has undertaken. He says, the fees are still a little confusing because the quote has three different fee tables, and this every Signia product that I've seen has this, and this is why I've struggled with it. He says, all are represented in a slightly different way. Depending on who you are, this is either super transparent or designed to confuse, or both. So in this process, I learned three things, says Jonathan. The first is that Signia allows investors a lot of flexibility, so you can really build your own portfolio. You can build your RA to align exactly with what your other investment strategy is, as long as you are Regulation 28 compliant. Secondly, Signia is really cheap, and the fees are confusing. Signia quotes an annual fee as low as 0.36% inclusive, but then show an effective annual fee of 0.52% in year one, 0.46% in year two in the same document, which is still good, but what actually is it? The effective annual cost seems to be the what you are really charged amount, which is a 0.52%. So the 0.52 EAC is basically the lowest I could get with the available Signia products. The main downside is that international equity is all S&P 500 and not a true global spread, because the S&P 500 ETF is almost 0.5% cheaper than the MSCI World. So when he says effective annual cost, what he's talking here is the platform fee, the brokerage fee, and the TER of the product.
Yeah, Alice.
So he says the biggest issue for me is because of the market movement, there's really no way of realistically checking what it is that you're being charged. Because remember, the total expense ratio gets deducted from the dividends you're due to receive. And so you never actually see that as a cost on your statement. So you see the platform fee, but the TER you'll never actually see. And that makes it so hard. That's why we always forget about that fee. He says you really just have to trust the provider, which I hate, because the quoted fees are always absurdly vague for all providers. What you can do in this case, if you wanted to know, so those minimum disclosure documents, the total expense ratio that they declare in those are always retroactive fees. It's not what it will be. It's what it has been. So if you want to know what you paid for a product in the past year, you can always go look at that and then add it yourself manually if you remember, which I 100% will not. He says third RAs don't have to provide less returns than the rest of your portfolio. That's the third thing he learned. So now he's got three options and the highest quoted fee for all three of the options. He says, my question is whether or not the last option is a good shout or whether such a large component of global property is not a good idea for some reason. Which would you do and which would Simon do? So these are, hang on, these are his options.
No, but quick on the fee. So I'm just checking my Alan Gray statement and they do two things. They take me the investment management fee. And that's not all Alan Gray product. And they show me that fee too and work the percentage. And then they put a platform fee on top. So in other words, what I'm saying is Signia, the TER, which is internal to the product, they will probably still disclose that to you on a statement.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah. So you will get some sight of it.
All right. So these are his three, Jonathan's three options. So the first is a standard with the maximum equity exposure and maximum offshore exposure, which includes the bond index, 15% in the bond index fund. So he would do top 40, MSCI World, a listed property index tracker fund, and all bond index fund. Then the second option, the cost of that is 0.67%, which is really not bad. His second option is the cheapest standard max equity exposure with the maximum offshore exposure, which is top 40, S&P 500, listed property index tracker, and all bond index at 0.52%. And the option, the third option he has no cash and no bonds. So 70% top 40, 5% S&P 500, 25% global property at 0.53%. I don't know if I would do 25% global property.
It's a lot of property. I mean, Keelan Glouville, who is a property whiz, says sort of 15, maybe 20 at max.
Yeah, why don't you up that S&P 500 holding, rather, to 15 or so, and then just drop down the global property?
And then you can manage the – so it's age-dependent, but if you've got time on your side, you don't want cash and bonds. I mean, they're nice. So I think the reason why a lot of RAs peeps put them in there is A, because they're lazy, and B, because the theory is that when markets collapse, the bonds won't. The truth is they both collapse. But if you've got time on your side, then there's no mad rush to have lots of cash or bonds in there. And you can manage it yourself. You've got an emergency fund. That's a lot of cash. It's already dragging. If you're in your late 40s or 50s, sure, you want to pull that down, but no mad rush to it.
So just explain to me again the Regulation 28. How much can you have offshore and how much can you have in property? And is that property allocation for just local property or can that be global property as well?
Good question. I think it's local. So offshore you can now have 30% and an additional 5 in Africa, excluding South Africa. So you could have 35. You're going to be hard-pressed to find an African investment vehicle to put it into, however. So it's 30%. Local equity can't be more than 75%. And then I can't remember what the others are.
Man, so if I were you, actually, Jonathan, what I would do is I would do 70% top 40, the full 30% S&P 500, and then 5% in property.
Yeah.
Because property is also kind of not my favorite investment. I checked myself there before I
raised myself. So they're not giving it there, et cetera. So a lot of the Reg 28 is more than anything, it's not prescribing so much where you have to go. It is basically saying the caps
no
that you can have.
No more than this, yeah.
Correct. So, typically it's like, you can't have more than 75% local equity. You can't have more than 30% offshore investments. You can't have more than, I think, it's whatever it is in property, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So what I would do is work it backwards, max out the offshore equity, and then rest into local.
All right, Stephen shared a tweet by Karen Richards that it, like, I honestly didn't know this, and I don't know if maybe I knew this and just forgot that I knew it. Karen says REIT dividends, or on REIT dividends, there are still those quite insistent that REIT dividends, so REIT is real estate investment trust. Mm-hmm. So all of the stuff that makes up all of our property ETFs, basically. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Yeah.
She says there are still those quite insistent that REIT dividends qualify for the interest exemption. They do not.
They do not.
I'm not in the business of arguing, but for clarity, this is the situation as per the tax legislation. So if you have property ETFs and you have a lot of them, make sure that you start them in your tax-free savings account because that 23,000, 23,500 tax exemption that you get from interest, you do not get if you get it from REIT REIT investments. Ria finally took ownership of an apartment that she bought off plan. She says, I can finally call it mine 3 years after I signed the offer to purchase and 2 years later than it should have been transferred to my name. That's terrible. She says, during this time, all my savings went into a money market account with the idea of putting a big lump sum towards the repayment. After the monthly bond repayment, levies, rates, and everything else, I still make about 900 rand per month profit because I rent it out, which I set aside for maintenance, etc. I save about 8,000 rand per month, and my outstanding loan home on that property is about 1 million rand. Do I put everything towards repaying the bond as soon as possible, apart from the 33,000 rand a year tax-free allocation? Do I invest everything in ETFs and let the rental income continue to pay off the bond since she's in the positive there? Or do I go halvesies and do half into the bond and half into ETFs? I love it when people are like super unsure and they're like, okay, let me do half-half.
Yeah, so I mean, truthfully, that life is the gray in the middle a bit, but most often it's a bad decision. Short answer is don't put your 8,000 extra savings per month into the bond because you will reduce your interest payment and therefore you will reduce your tax saving that you can have. And this is because it's not a primary residence. So actually, you don't mind the extra. You don't need to pay that bond off quickly because someone else is paying it for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Man, why is this going so quickly? Like suddenly we have a dedicated...
Because we're time traveling.
We have a dedicated question thing and suddenly
time travel
just, like,
clears the mind.
Going through it. So Dave is trying to reach financial independence in 4 years and he blew my mind about the kid thing. So he's paid off his short-term debt. And he has also listened to 162 Fat Wallet episodes in 4 months. Like, how this man hasn't killed us, I don't understand.
So it's 40 a month, so it's one a day and two a day on weekends.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry, dude.
He says, I've been amazed by the consistency of your message across 162
episodes.
Actually,
yeah, there's someone who can measure us.
He says, I think the only two things that have changed are that you are no longer buying DBX World, you're now buying Ashburton 1200, and your attitude to tax has changed from pay tax to try to only pay tax once. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
He says, after all 162 podcasts, I have the following points or questions lingering. Man. So he says, the first of all, why haven't you two moved to Durban?
It's complicated.
I don't have a good answer to that question.
I mean, I have lots of good answers. It involves a cat, a mother-in-law, and my wife's job.
Mine involves family also, family and friends. Like, it would be so sad for me to move to Durban now. Like, my best friend stays less than 10 minutes away from my house. It would be sad for me to move to Durban and live there alone.
I don't know if any of my friends listen to this, but, like, if I got the chance, sorry, peeps. That, I'm moving.
You know who is moving to Durban is Sean Combrink.
Yeah.
Lucky.
Which was a surprise.
Yeah.
Yes, lucky man.
Dave says, a lot of people are worried that when they die, their dependents will be left stranded while the estate is sorted. The first thing is that some life insurances pay an advance, maybe about 10%. And another option is to set up regular payments to another account in their name to cover the key expenses. Set it up now and be ahead for when accounts are frozen. So that's a really good idea, providing they don't go and stick their fingers into that account while you are still alive.
No, sure. But I mean, so my mother did that and we knew, I mean, she had cancer, so we knew it was happening and she moved money into my account because they're just incidental expenses and, well, I mean, like a funeral, right? That's not free, et cetera, et cetera. And in the case of my wife, there is a credit card with cash in it in her name. She could have raided it, I suppose. That, you know, and truthfully, if she has that, silly, right? Because then I'm dead. She's got no money and it's her fault. Not that I'm dead, but that she has no money.
Well, we hope that is so.
If I'm dead and it's her fault, like, you got to do me right.
Can I take the money then?
Money's yours.
So you can't open a bank account in somebody else's name without them knowing it.
Because you can't figure it.
Right.
But what you could do is open it in their name, put the money in, and then just not give them the password and, you know, my letter for when I'm dead. So you could stick it in there and, you know, that. Truthfully, yeah, mean, if you're worried about someone stealing the money before you die.
So I do know that life insurance premiums do cover, do pay out immediately to help you cover this sort of stuff. And you can make it so that they pay out everything to you immediately so that it doesn't, because it doesn't go into their estate.
But what is immediately?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean,
I don't know. I mean, my mother passed on a Wednesday. We buried her on a Monday. That, have they paid by then? And I mean, the...
Do you have to pay the funeral home? Like, are they, you're like, cool, I want that coffin. They're like, give me 50,000 rand or what?
Yeah.
Or do they go, oh, I see that you're really sad. We can wait until the funeral.
And when you say I want that cheap coffin, they're like, no, you don't. And I'm like, trust me, yes, I want that cheap one. And they want the monies. And it's not just the funeral home. You know, and it depends. I mean, if you're in a church, they probably want donations. Are you going to be feeding people? If you're burying someone, the cemetery, I mean, someone, et cetera, et cetera.
What about funeral policies? Don't they pay out immediately?
Again, sure, what's immediately? But I mean, in short answer, yes, they should.
I like the idea of having a bank account in somebody else's name that you hand over to them when you die.
You see, and in my case as well, as remember, I don't have any life policy, so my wife gets my estate. So, I mean, now that I think about it, so she currently has a job and could, in many senses, collapse her costs. But, I mean, there's some tricksies there. I mean, now that I think about it, considering, let's say it takes a year to wrap up my estate, it might not be enough cash for her.
Mm.
Awkward.
Yeah. All right. Dave says, with tax-free savings account for kids. Mm-hmm. This really blew my mind because he is so right about this. He said, it's not so binary, like, because we tend to say, don't max it out for your kids because when they turn 18 years old, it's theirs and they can do with it what they please. And they only get that one allocation and they're going to squander it because mm-hmm. we have no faith in 18-year-olds, apparently.
Hey, yeah, I was 18.
So was I. If you had given me a large amount of money, I would not, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, try to give 1 to 2 full years of tax-free allocation. Ask friends and families rather to pay towards that than buy another toy for the toy box. This gives them 18 years to internalize the compound effect, something that took me 15 years after I understood the maths. It also gives a real discussion point about the money. It still leaves 90% of the allowance, yeah. Which could change for the child. I think this is a brilliant idea.
Yeah, no, I think that really, really does work. And we've run the numbers. That if you put 33,000 on day one, when they, at age 65, it'll generate 100,000 a year in today's money. That's real.
Isn't it 10,000 a month?
Well, you've got to decide. So Patrick did it and got to 10,000. I think I was more conservative on growth estimates.
Okay.
But I mean, 100 a year, 10 a month, almost 100, 120 a year. It's in that ballpark of around 8 or 10 a month. I think I used a 7% real return.
But this is amazing, because what it also does is it gives your kids that period between 18 and like 22 when they're not earning money yet, they're still upskilling and whatever, and that money can still grow in that period until they can start contributing. Or like at 25, or in my case, I only started investing when I was 28.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's a long, long time to give an account time to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And if they then use that money to pay for university or to buy a car or whatever, then they do still have that allocation for when they come to their senses later. I think this is brilliant.
And if they use it on drug, sex and rock and roll, then, well, they've still got, you know, 400 and something thousand to go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's brilliant. Dave says, the last point is that how people think about risk bothers me. They say something is risky or aggressive, but risk has time and context factors. So I don't know if you guys remember this, but about in the 160s, we did a whole show on risk. I think 165, we did a whole show on risk and we kind of discussed this. He says, for example, cash is riskier than investments over time because of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really true. Anyway, he says, thanks for being awesome and helping me catch up on the South African financial scene.
Yeah, and a quick point on that risk, and it's something which I've been pondering a lot around, is that we tend to view risk binary. In other words, either it will or it won't. And truthfully, risk is usually that gray bit in the middle. It's not so binary. Yeah, an example, everyone's like, oh, we're going to be Zimbabwe. No, that's not going to happen. But equally, we're not going to be Ireland. I mean, South Africa's future is somewhere between Ireland and Zimbabwe. Those are the two extremes. Yet our brain, and there's cognitive biases to why, goes to the extremes. Yeah. And life is very, very seldom an extreme.
So if you guys want to know about this, so we've done, we did a kind of a risk in general, and then we did another episode on stock market risk a bit later. And no, we are going to do it.
We would later. Have done it by the time.
No, we wouldn't have done it. We'll do it next month. So in November, we're going to do another podcast on risk. But they, I agree with Dave here that there are risks sometimes that we do not internalize. For example, the risk of inflation. It's a risk that literally every single person is subject to, and we never account for it properly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Dr. Dan is wondering about RA allocations. He says, I am at times a government employee, and when I can't choose not to, they contribute to the government employee pension fund on my behalf. I'm in the process of getting hold of my current pension statement. I assume that the maximum 27.5% contribution is the combined total that goes to my government employee pension fund, as well as the amount that I contribute to my own RA. Yes,
correct.
You are correct.
Or 350,000, whichever is greater.
Yeah. Smaller.
Smaller.
It took me a second there. This is like when people say the rand strengthens. Every time I have to like sit down for a second and think about what that means. Dr. Dan also says, why are you called Just One Lap? I'm sure you get asked that frequently, but I haven't heard the answer yet.
Just one lap at life. Don't f*** it up.
Yeah. Mm. Live well, live with money so you can have bubbles.
That too.
So Jens has a warning about insurance updates. He says, just a reminder to completely read any updates of your insurance contract. I started with a new company in 2017, a new insurance company. I only read the 2018 insurance update superficially, and then I got a surprise when I read the 2019 update. My father-in-law's car, which was insured on my policy, had the name of the owner changed from his name to my name without any communication by the insurance company in 2018 or in 2019. When I queried this with the insurer, they said that only vehicles that I owned could be insured, and I was informed that my father-in-law's car was therefore not insured in the two-year period. Thankfully, there were no claims. I'm still trying to get this issue fully resolved by the insurer after 2 months. So his point is read.
Yeah, and also read. So I poked my car insurer company and tried to get my fee cut. And I've got all these bells and whistles that I don't want.
Like
what? So if I'm more than X days or something from home, they'll pick me in a hotel for 2 days. No, and that's why I've got a credit card. If my car isn't fixed in X days, they'll give me a loan a car. No, and the reason why I don't want them is because A, I have emergency funds, and B, because I worry about the T's and C's. Like if I try and claim my night in the hotel, you know, and I mean, you know, how far do I have to be? Are they going to only say, well, 3-star hotel? I mean, it's just, I don't want all those T's and C's and little bits of funny bits on it.
Look at you, cheese boy, too good for a 3-star hotel.
No, I'm happy with a 3-star, but you know, what happens if I'm in Cape Town? They don't have 3 stars in Cape Town. Yeah, it's just like, they promise you stuff and then you come to claim and then nickel and dime you. And
oh man, and insurance companies are so bad.
And when I'm in a situation where going down and I'm now like, you know, far from home and my car's broken down, I don't want to have to be fighting with my insurer about what I can or can't do. I just want to be flashing credit cards at people.
I think when you review your insurance, you should always ask yourself, what can my emergency fund cover here?
Mm-hmm.
And we have spoken about this before. Self-insurance is a thing. It should be a thing. It's something that you should always keep an eye on.
Yeah.
So Errol has some counterparty concerns. He says, we are now, after some fat wallets, avid ETF investors, which is awesome for my wife and our future. We are 45 years old, so we have a 20-year investment plan, an investment plan in place in terms of our ETF investing. And this is on top of the RAs and pension funds that they already have. So they've now just started this journey with the ETFs for themselves. He says, we have about 10,000 rands worth of ETFs in Ashburton and Satrix 40 through Easy Equities. What if the website shuts down or the company goes under? what happens to the money that I invested and how would I get access to it so should something like that ever happen? I don't want to ask them directly for an answer because I'm scared they'll be biased.
So, not an unfair question. Assuming it is an ETF as distinct from an ETN. So an ETN is a promise to pay the profit, and if a company goes broke, you stand at the end of the queue to get your money out. An ETF is they physically hold the assets in a special purpose vehicle. They have insurance over those assets, and in theory, if Satrix went to the wall, the shares exist there, and we would get our net asset value out. It might be messy and it would take some time. And by time, that could be months. It could be years. I don't know. I mean, we don't have an example locally, but it would be you are protected. The risk is, of course, is that what happens if some Satrix employee steals all 100 billion rands worth of shares that Satrix holds within those SPVs and sells them and takes the money and dashes to Canada or somewhere exotic. Then it starts to get a little bit murky. But so how they protect that is they do daily audits and et cetera, to try and protect that. The short answer is that, to my mind, I don't worry about counterparty risk in an ETF.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about counterparty risks with a broker?
So, okay, stockbroker, there are two types. Are there a stockbroker and you have a BDA account with the JSC in which...
What does BDA stand for?
Broker-dealer account. Broker-dealer account? Sounds good.
I don't know how to verify. So.
No, if I'm wrong, someone out there will mail you in November. And then the JSC has a guaranteed fund. So you can look on the JSC balance sheet and you see a billion plus of ZAR, which is just for that and to protect you in that sense. But, you know, is a billion enough? Well, time will tell. But then it's also depending on, you know, for example, who owns the broker. Now, on standard online share trading owned by Standard Bank, they're probably going to pony up because they've got the cash. So in theory, you've got a very, very slight counterparty risk. Then again, if the broker goes bankrupt, no worries. Your concern is crime. Your concern is theft of the assets. Because if the broker goes bankrupt, your shares still sit there in that BDA account. And then you get financial services providers, which is, for example, Easy Equities, where they have World Trader, a separately held vehicle, and all the shares go into that. Again, daily audit process, and they are required by FSCA to carry insurance on that.
Okay, so if they go bust, they have insurance that will pay investment.
No, if they go bust, it's neither here nor there because Easy Equities has gone bust, but those shares are not part of their business model, so those shares still sit there. If in the process of going bust, the stockbroker started to swap the shares out of there to pay for car refinances and bubbles and stuff like that, they will have insurance. Will it be enough if they took it all? No.
So are you saying that that Global Trader is the stockbroker behind Easy Equities?
No, so it's not. It's World Trader. So World Trader is the SPV which holds the assets. They will be utilizing a stockbroker to buy those shares. Because no one but stockbrokers can interact directly on the JSC. Yeah, I know. I can look by your face. It's not.
So hang on a second. So the reason that they do that is so that the shares that I own don't form part of Easy Equities' balance sheet because it sits on mine.
Okay. And they put them in a special purpose vehicle just to make that arm's lengthy type thing.
Okay. Yes. And the insurance is then for that special purpose vehicle?
Correct. For the special purpose vehicle paid by the FSP for the special purpose vehicle. The short answer is that you always have some level of counterparty risk. If somebody is able to steal every last share held by that stockbroker or by that FSP or by that ETF, the contingencies held to cover it won't be enough. It's just that simple. The expectation is that the practicality of stealing every last share, etc., is so close to zero as to be insignificant.
Okay. The probability, you mean.
There we go.
So Dave has some ideas for Dirk, who wasn't sure how to handle his tax between the two countries. Dave has seen some stuff, apparently, in this regard. I think this is a different Dave from the other Dave who listened to all the shows.
Who has heard some stuff.
Yeah, who has heard some stuff, but mostly on the show. So he says, the first thing he wants to say to Dirk is get professional advice. He says, yeah. Use the following as a prompt to unpack some of the issues while getting professional advice. I'm a professional, but not in tax or in finance. I've spent several years living and working in the USA on a work permit and a visa and submitting tax returns to both countries. He says, to answer Simon, it is possible to have dual citizenship in South Africa. I think there might be a requirement to inform or request permission from the Department of Home Affairs, mm-hmm. who are people you never want to interact with, when applying for citizenship for another country. He says, when Dick got his USA green card, he went fully into the USA tax books. The IRS taxes US citizens on a global income. Any TFSA held in his name in South Africa, while not taxed in South Africa, would probably be assessed for tax in the USA. That is terrifying. He says there's a double taxation agreement between South Africa and the USA, but I can't see any tax advantage to a person who has tax residency elsewhere. But a health warning, I'm an engineer, not a tax specialist. So what he's saying here, he's flagging TFSAs for people who stay in the US. He says there are a number of SARS criteria for triggering tax residency in South Africa based on the period of time spent in the country. Mm-hmm. To keep it simple, Dirk should limit the time in the country to 90 days or less per tax year to avoid being a tax resident in South Africa. If he does become a tax resident, SARS will want a share of his US income and he will have to rely on the double taxation agreement to limit total tax. He says, while the US tax rates on income tax are lower than in South Africa, US taxpayers also pay social security tax and might even pay state taxes.
Yeah.
So there's not really a benefit there. He says the 180 days that you refer to, Simon, is for tax residents who meet several requirements to be exempt from paying tax in South Africa on income earned offshore. This will be capped at R1 million in the next tax year, so that's the 2020 financial year, and makes working in a low or no tax regime like the Middle East less attractive to South African residents working overseas. I will no doubt prompt some of them to do financial immigration from SA. He says, for FYI, the issue of tax residency is in tax law one of intent and doesn't require financial immigration. Financial immigration is a Reserve Bank exchange control process that also results in the person ceasing to be a tax resident in South Africa.
So tax law, and he's right, 2 points I want to pick up on. One is tax is always about intent, and intent is often hard to prove, which is why, for example, I trade and invest in different accounts, because if I buy a share and it turns out to be a Steinhoff tomorrow and I sell it, I can say to SARS, my intent was long-term because I bought it in my long-term account and I have 20 years of track record. His point up front was, in cases of tax, always professional advice. We have lots of thoughts and we can Google away and et cetera, and give and send in directions, but always professional advice, because so tax is complex.
So complex. And,
changing.
I speak to our tax elves often, and so often when I talk to them, we would talk about an issue and they'd be like, I have no idea. And then they'd go down a rabbit hole. They know where to look for answers mm-hmm. better than we do.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's literally like a person who has a doctorate in tax law who's like, oh boy, I'm stumped by this one. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just changes. You know, that's the other trick.
Has SARS ever asked you to see those different accounts? Because it's a good idea, but I wonder if it'll hold up.
I've been audited, and I don't know. I can't remember. Not in recent times. I honestly can't remember.
Okay. Brendan and his wife are toying with the idea of immigration. He says, my wife and I max out our tax-free savings account every year. And we currently invest roughly 50% of our monthly income into a range of bonds, dividend ETFs, property ETFs, and other international ETFs.
Sure.
We're both 38 and have had the idea of immigration on our minds for several years. Although we haven't taken the leap and don't immediately plan to do so, it's nevertheless something we would consider in the future. My wife has an RA which she contributes to minimally in comparison to the rest of our joint investments. I don't have an RA. the reason neither of us are very focused on RAs is because we would be heavily penalized for closing the accounts early to immigrate. I have two questions. First of all, what kind of penalties would we be looking at for closing an RA early and withdrawing the funds if we were to one day immigrate? So as far as I understand it, you can immigrate your, like when the, a special law applies when you immigrate your RA.
I have no idea.
Okay.
For some reason, 26% came into my head. But there's also when you immigrate, SARS just takes 10% of all your money, and then Shuttleworth took it to the Concorde and won, and so I don't know where it stands.
Okay. He says, would it be worthwhile, even considering any penalties, for me to open an RA since my wife already has one, and for both of us to start contributing the 27.5% to each of them? Alternatively, we could continue with the ETFs, which we can withdraw at any time. In the end, immigration is not a definite plan, but rather something we're open to, and we've therefore not focused on RAs up to this point.
Yeah, sure. So the lack of definite plan makes me think that you should be utilizing to some degree the benefit of a retirement annuity, the immediate tax benefit. If you're currently saving 50%, however, that might then just become all very moot. Now you've got such a savings rate that you are financially free within 15 years.
So I'm trying to think what the spreadsheet is here. The spreadsheet is the 27.5% somebody posted on Twitter about this. Now I'm confused by the word, but the 27.5% tax break that you get from SARS versus what it would cost you to take your money out of the country, out of an RA and out of the country. Because I think when you financially immigrate, the penalties that you pay on an RA product specifically is different from the penalties that you would pay.
Yeah, because you've received the tax benefit. And the reason why SARS gives you that tax benefit is because they catch you at the end. Remember, they give you 500K tax-free and then sliding scale. But they're basically saying, we'll catch you up at the end. And of course, in theory, the money that you've put into the RA is much bigger when you take it out of the RA because of growth. So SARS is happy with that. They've kicked a can down the road. And if you're leaving early, they're like, hang on, we gave you benefit. We want that kickback.
Can you remember in that episode we did with Candace Payne years ago, whether or not we spoke about this?
I can't remember. I know we've had the conversation before somewhere in the 100-something archives of this, but I can't remember what the answer is.
Maybe go listen to that Candace Payne episode and see if you can find an answer. I can't remember. And if you don't speak to Candace Payne about this, she'll know.
And Payne, not the sore way.
Pain with an E.
That's it. And a Y.
No.
No.
John has some great news about fiber costs. He says the cost of MWeb unthrottled, uncapped fiber has now dropped from 899 Rand to 399 Rand.
Yo.
The catch is they don't drop the price unless you specifically phone and request the new package. So there you have it. Yeah.
The thing is, I'm like, every fiber in the world, like when you sign up for the fiber, you get a list of peeps that you can subscribe to. I can only have my unit, my block of flats can only have one provider.
Oh.
Yeah. Because they ran a cable over a wall, so I don't have an open access network.
Oh.
Bleak.
All right, that's it from the Just One Lap team this week. We are only 40 minutes in, which makes me think we are the problem.
Well, no, because we do a 20-minute up front, we have a question. Your questions are hard. You are the problem. Anyway, enjoy wherever you are right now on holiday.
That's it from the Just One Lap team this week. This is a show about questions. Send yours to ask at justonelap.com. You can join the Fat Wallet community group on Facebook. Thank you to Aiden and Kay for being our community wizards. My name is Christopher Nieden. Thank you to Simon Brown. We'll catch you next week.
Hey, and 31 October.
We are in Cape Town on 31 October, which I keep forgetting to mention.